Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Megan. That was very nice. Recently, there's been some news reports from San Bernardino in California, and I'm just reading a news clipping here. It says the city attorney of San Bernardino is under scrutiny for telling residents to lock their doors and load their guns during a city council meeting. The official explained that because the city just outside Los Angeles is bankrupt and slashing public safety budgets, people will need to start protecting themselves. Apparently, crime in that city is double what it is in nearby cities. Also, recently I read gun sales are up since the election. One report says 30% boost in sales. So it seems like in society there's a concern about safety and security. Do you feel secure? In this day and age we live, it's one of uncertainty, and we can see things moving quickly to the end of the age. What does God's word say about security? Well, the title of my sermon is Psalms 91 and Your Security Needs. In researching parts of the Bible that dealt with security, I found that Psalm 91 just came up so many times, and it's a really beautiful psalm and gives so much reassurance in this difficult time that we live in. Let's go to Psalm 91. Now, usually at the beginning of a psalm, it tells you who the author is, and this particular psalm does not. And people that study the structure of the Bible and the Psalms say that if there's no author mentioned, go back to the previous psalm to see who that was. In this case, it was Moses, a prayer of Moses. And so Psalm 91 is most likely a psalm from Moses. And if you read some of the things that Moses talks about here are very akin to what happened in the wilderness, the protection that was needed there. Verse 1, it says, "He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." Verse 2, "I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust." Now, in times past, we've used this psalm as talking about the place of safety. It's where we all go into a place, a secret place, where we're protected. And maybe that is the case. But in that place of safety, we shouldn't be concerned about, in verse 7, it says, 1,000 shall fall at your side and 10,000 at your right side, but it shall not come near you. So in that place of safety, we shouldn't have to worry about our fellow servants, you know, our fellow saints, given a place of safety, dying there. So maybe this applies more generally to where we are. And in the wilderness, as Moses led the Israelites, the safety went with them. The fire by night and the cloud by day. So where it says in verse 1, "He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty," maybe alluding to the comfort of that cloud in that desert sun. But it does allude to there that we are to dwell in the secret place of the Most High. We are to find our refuge with God, that God is our source of protection. In the Hebrew, it indicates a place of permanence, a place that we rely on God continually. It's not something that we need just when we're struggling, we go to God, but all the time we need to rely on God. In verses 3 to 8, it lists promises. He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall trust. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. Verse 5, you shall not be afraid of terror by night, nor for the arrow that flies by day, nor for the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor for the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Verse 8, only with your eyes shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked. So those promises are sandwiched between two statements, and that in verse 1 it says that he that dwells in the secret place, and in verse 9, because you have made the Lord, which is your refuge, which is my refuge, even the Most High, your habitation. So it's saying that when we make God our shelter and we live with God and have God in our lives, that God will provide those promises of protection. In verse 3, it says, surely he shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler. Now, a snare is a fine piece of wire that's looped around and tied to itself, so it can tighten itself. If you put the snare around your wrist and pull it, it will tighten. So when an animal gets in a snare and it catches on their leg or their wing or their neck and they try to flee, it tightens up. The more they try to flee, the more they're caught. Now, we're not really birds, and we, you know, don't have a fowler trying to snare us, but allegorically, we have Satan trying to snare us. And in Timothy, it actually mentions a snare. Let's go to 1 Timothy 6 to look at a snare that could be for us. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9, it says, but they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. And verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So I guess wealth or lust for riches can be a snare to us, take us away from God. I've got a quote here from Bernard from commentary. It says, are not the riches of this world then the snare of the devil? How few can we find who can boast of freedom from this snare? How many who grieve that they seem to be themselves too little enmeshed in the net, and who still labour and toil with their strength to involve and struggle themselves more and more? You who have left all and followed the Son of Man, who has not where to lay his head, rejoice and say, he has delivered we from the snare of the fowlers. Kind of an interesting quote there. Sometimes we can feel kind of the more we put our effort into life, it just seems that we're tangled up in the world. Let's go back to Psalm 91 again. In verse 3 it says, surely he shall deliver you from the noisome pestilence, from disease or the plague. I have a story here. Taken from last century, from the 18th century, I believe. It says, Lord Craven lived in London when he sat with that sad calamity, the plague raged. His house was in that part of the town called Craven Buildings. On the plague growing epidemic, his lordship to avoid the danger, resolved to go to his seat in the country. His coach and six were accordingly at the door, his baggage put up, and all things in readiness for his journey. As he was walking through his hall with his hat on, his cane under his arm, and putting on his gloves in order to step into his carriage, he overheard his servant who served him saying to another servant, "I suppose, but my lord's quitting London to avoid the plague, that his God lives in the country and not in town." That servant said this in simplicity of his heart, as really believing a plurality of gods. The speech, however, struck Lord Craven very sensibly and made him pause. "My God," he thought, "lives everywhere and can preserve me in town as well as the country. I will even stay where I am." The ignorance of that servant just now preached to me a very useful sermon. Lord, pardon this unbelief and that distrust of your providence, which made me think of running from your hand. He immediately ordered his horses to be taken from the coach, the baggage to be taken in. He continued in London and was remarkably useful amongst his sick neighbours and never caught the infection. It's kind of a nice story illustrating this verse here. The story helps us realise that safety is where God is, and God is wherever we are. That we can rely on God wherever we are, and that when trouble comes, there may be others less fortunate that need our care. Let's look at verse 4 in Psalm 91. It says, "He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall trust." I searched the internet for a picture of a bird covering its chicks, and it's just a beautiful picture of protection when a bird covers its chicks with its wings. In Psalm 64 and verse 4 it says, "I long to dwell in your tent forever and take refuge in the shelter of your wings." So God does provide us that protection like a bird protects its own. In verses 5 and 6 it talks about being afraid at different times of the day and for different things. In verse 5 it says, "You shall not be afraid for the terror by night," so by night, "not for the arrow that flies by day, nor for the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor for the destruction that wastes at noonday." So what this is saying is that we don't need to be afraid of anything at any time. In verse 7 it says, "A thousand shall fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked." In verse 9, "Because you have made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, your habitation." Verse 10, "There shall no evil befall you, neither shall any plague come near your dwelling." I guess in San Bernardino, California, people are buying guns to protect themselves, but how do guns protect you from the plague? You know, unless you've got a sealed house and fully self-contained and you've got food and provisions and no one else comes into your home, you know, you can't protect yourself from the plague. So this is where these promises are so, so amazing, because God can protect you. Protect you not only from harm, from people trying to hurt you, but also from the plague, from disease. In verse 11 it says, "For he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. They shall bear you up in their hands lest you dash your foot against a stone." Wow. And notice here it talks about angels. God shall give his angels charge over you. No, it's not just, you know, we talk about a guardian angel, you know, your own guardian angel, but here it talks about angels in the plural. So that's comforting to know. Now, we know angels are there to minister to us, but when God charges them to look after you, that's a special command. It's like, you know, we have a role as parents looking after our children, but if someone said, I want you to protect this person, you would know that you have extra responsibility. And here God is saying to the angels, I charge you to protect these people. So the angels have a special role, a special duty to protect us. Let's look at some of the power of the angels. In Psalm 103, just over a few pages, Psalm 103, verse 19 to 22, it says, the Lord has prepared his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom rules over all. Verse 20, bless the Lord, you his angels that excel in strength, that do his commandments, hearkening unto the voice of his word. Bless you the Lord, all you hosts, you ministers of his that do his pleasure. So it says there the angels have that excel in strength. How many angels does it take to restrain Satan? You know, we think of Satan as being powerful, but how many angels does it take to restrain Satan? Let's have a look at that in Revelation. Revelation 20. Revelation 20 and verse 1, it says, and I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. Revelation 20 and verse 2, it says, and he laid hold on that dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more. One angel. Isn't that amazing? So God's angels do have amazing power. And if we look at Luke 8, look at Luke 8 and verse 31, it says, the demons kept begging Jesus not to send them into the bottomless pit. Now, this is where the demons were cast out into the herd of pigs. Well, they were talking to Jesus and said, they begged him not to send them to the bottomless pit. So if that's the fate of the demons as well, then there's a strong inference there that one angel not only put Satan in the bottomless pit, but all the demons as well. So those angels who are part of God's team have incredible power. And it seems almost flippant that God doesn't do this himself as the awesome creator of these angels. No, God doesn't do it himself. He doesn't even get Jesus Christ to do it. He gives an angel that job. Almost like to say, well, you know, you do it. Just shows how awesome the power of the angels is. Those that work for good. In Isaiah 37, Isaiah 37 and verse 36, it says, then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. That's 185,000 And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So here it says one angel kills the Assyrian army of 185,000. The same account is written in 2 Kings 19, verse 35. Isn't that amazing? One angel killed 185,000 men overnight. And in the morning, the Israelites looked and saw all these dead corpses. I wonder how dead a corpse can be. You know, could there be a live corpse? Well, these were dead corpses. Almost like this angel did a really good job of killing these corpses. They were dead corpses. So how many angels are there? Let's go to Revelation for an indication. There's quite a few places in the Bible that talk about the number of angels. Revelation 5 and verse 11, it said, "And I beheld and I heard the voice of many angels around about the throne and the beasts and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands." That's 100 million and thousands of thousands. It's almost like, what did John do? Did he count them all? Or was he kind of miraculously given the number? Or this is an approximation. There was just hundreds of millions and thousands of thousands. There's a lot of angels. Also, there's other parts of the Bible. In Daniel 7:10, it talks about thousands ministered to him. Tens of thousands times tens of thousands stood before him, stood before God. Psalm 86:17, the chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. Deuteronomy 33 and verse 2, tens of thousands of holy ones with flaming fire at his right hand. There are a lot of angels. Those who, in our church, in our congregation, who maybe feel vulnerable, can take great comfort in these scriptures. These scriptures are just so awe-inspiring in times when we feel vulnerable. In Psalm 91 and verse 12, it says, "And they," that's the angels, "shall bear you up in their hands, lest you shall dash your foot against a stone." So it's saying here that angels will hold you in their hands. I guess that could be literally. If we go to Matthew 18 and verse 10, it says, and this is, Christ has some small children with him, and he says to his disciples, "Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say to you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." So here again, it's plural, their angels. So the small children have a number of angels protecting them. And those angels are in heaven beholding God. They're talking with God. So that's pretty amazing in itself, you know, how they can be there and here at the same time. It just boggles my mind. In Hebrews 1:14, it says that angels are ministering spirits. Hebrews 1 and verse 14 says, "Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation?" So the angels are there for us to minister to us. And as Psalm says, you know, when we stumble, they're there to catch us. In In Revelation 22, I found this very interesting. I hadn't seen this before, but Revelation 22, verses 8 and 9, ties in well with what Mr. Wickman said about worshipping angels. Verse 8, it says, "And I, John, saw these things and heard them, and when I heard and seen, I fell down to worship before the feet of the angel which showed me these things." So John was so awe-inspired about what he had seen and what he'd been told by this angel, he went to bow down. In verse 9, "Then the angel said to me, 'Don't do it. For I am your fellow servant and of your brethren the prophets and of them which keep the sayings of this book. Worship God.'" So don't do it, worship God. What I didn't get when I read this previously is it says, the angel said to him, "For I am your fellow servant." I am your fellow servant. So the angel is Paul's, John's fellow servant. "And of them which keep this," "and of your brethren the prophets." So a fellow servant with the prophets. And it goes on to say, "And of them which keep the sayings of this book," which would be you and me. So we're fellow servants of God with the angels. And we just read in Hebrews 1:14 that those angels are ministering spirits to those who are called to salvation. It's like, wow, we're part of the same team. It's like God's the team leader and the angels have been given a job to look after us at this time when we are vulnerable. A bit like parents nurturing their children when they're vulnerable, but your children grow up. And so too we as humans, we're going to be glorified. And so too as parents, when we get old, our children will be able to help us out. And when we're glorified, we will be judging the angels. I'd say there'd be some pretty harsh judgment for the bad angels. There might be some good words to say for the angels that protected us. Now, in Psalm 91, that scripture about the angels holding you up, in verse 12, "They shall bear you up in their hands, lest you should dash your foot against a stone." This was used by Satan to tempt Christ in Matthew 4. If you keep your finger in both places, let's have a look at Matthew 4 to see what Satan said. Matthew 4 and verse 6, "And he said unto him, 'If you be the Son of God, cast yourself down, for it is written,'" and quote Psalm 91, verse 11 and 12, "he said, 'He shall give his angels charge concerning you.'" Let's see if it says that. In Psalms it says, "For he shall give his angels charge over you." But in Matthew 6, it misses out the rest of that verse. So Satan's left out the last bit of verse 11 in Psalm 91. It says, "To keep you in all your ways." So by leaving that out, it's almost like Satan was saying that you have unlimited protection by the angels. Jump off. They'll protect you because that's what the word says. But Christ responded with, "You shall not tempt God." So what does it mean for the angels to keep you in all your ways? What is that mean? What does that mean? Solomon in Proverbs 27:8, he says, "Like a bird that strays from its nest is a man who wanders from his home." It's like, you know, when we wander from having God as our dwelling, then We're in trouble, like a bird that wanders from its nest. It's away from its protection. If you think of Jonah was given a commission to go to Nineveh and give a warning. What did Jonah do? He went the opposite direction. It was not in accordance with God's will. He wasn't in the way. And were the angels there for him? Well, yeah, God sent an angel. And was it for his protection? Kind of. Well, for the sake of those men in the ship, he was thrown overboard so that their lives would be saved. And instead of protecting him, God had prepared a fish to eat him. So in some ways he was preserved in that fish. Jonah was out of his way. And instead of an angel to keep him, to stopping his foot being dashed, his whole body was thrown overboard. In Proverbs 3 and verse 23, it says, "Then you shall walk your way safely and your foot shall not stumble." Talking about taking on God's wisdom. In Psalm 91, we'll look at verse 14. It says, "Because he has set his love upon me." And these last few verses in Psalm 91 are as though God's talking. So it's like God's promises and specifically addressing us. So God says here in verse 14, "Because he has set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and will show him my salvation." So here God gives a number of promises specifically from God. The four wills. As if all the preceding promises weren't enough, then God provides four more. "I will set him on high. I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him." This really is a psalm of security. It's about God caring and providing that security for us. We can see that when a person puts their trust in God, they're protected by God. And, you know, we're human, and in this day and age we can feel insecure, and in some ways we have to prepare for the economy and, you know, the safety of our home, putting locks on the door and things like that. Sometimes we can have thoughts of, you know, needing to arm ourselves. But when we put God first, God promises to protect us. But there's another aspect to protecting yourself. You know, if you don't put your trust in God, when you go to protect yourself, to buy a gun or to have a safe room in your house or to store up months of food or whatever it is to provide that security for yourself, it's for yourself. And, you know, as a church, we're a body. There's more than just me. And, you know, it's easy to forget when we feel insecure that there's probably someone more vulnerable in our congregation that needs to be cared for. And that's the bigger picture as we minister to each other, that we should be considering our security. It's not just mine. We live in dangerous times, and it's comforting to know that we have the promises of God for protection from people that may cause us harm and for disease. At any time of day or night, no matter what the danger is. Thousands shall fall at the sight of you, but you will not be harmed. Making God our habitation gives us great comfort. Let's have reassurance and security that God will deliver you, set you on high, answer you when you call out, be with you in trouble, deliver and honor you, and give you a long life and give you eternal life. So I wish you all a great Sabbath afternoon and enjoyment of the fellowship afterwards.